You are listening to Service Course by The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
It's a nice mug you've got there, Lizzie. Excellent stuff. That's a very informal start, wasn't it? I'm with Lizzie Banks. We're just comparing cycling podcast mugs across a Zoom call. How you doing, Lizzie?
I'm very good, thank you, Tom. I've actually got a collection of three now, which is really, really nice, because I had my original one, my Giro one, which was given to me by Richard Moore at the Cycling Podcast Live in Manchester, which was actually the last time we saw each other in person, Tom. Can you believe that?
Shocking, isn't it? That was the last time I saw anyone connected to
anywhere. Last time I saw a single human in person.
Yeah, I think it was the last time I went out.
And that mug, I tragically smashed it in 2021 when I had a concussion.
I've been there.
But heartbroken. But I have glued it back together and it's now a toothbrush holder. Stacey Snyder very kindly sent me a pink and a yellow one. And now I have this beautiful one with the added buffalo motif from Stacey, courtesy of Orla Chenery.
You've got the feminine one. Yeah, I want one of those.
I have indeed.
That's very nice.
Yeah.
Well, Lizzie, listen, it's great to be back together. I want to talk in a minute. You are much closer to being a pro cyclist than in the past. But before we get onto that, I just want to say thanks to everybody, basically. I've had, over the last few weeks, I have had so many messages from listeners about the ECOS series that Lionel and Simon made. I was lucky enough to produce it. I've had so many wonderful, kind messages from people who have been enjoying it. And I just want to say thanks. It's been an absolute pleasure to do it. And I know Lionel's really, really proud of it. But I'm just so glad it's out in the world. And I know you enjoyed it as well, Lizzie, didn't you?
Yeah, it's been an absolutely phenomenal series. And I think that it's so important to have the story, but the production it's such a beautiful production, and the way that the music and the story is all linked together and the way that you've picked out the right bits of the story to link them up is just beautiful. And I have to say, I'm not really a podcast listener and I've just absolutely devoured these. But I'd love to know a bit more about how you put it together. Where do you get the inspiration for the music, for all of these beautiful links, everything that makes it so whimsical and that transports you to this beautiful place in Scotland where the clouds are suddenly changing and and you're hearing bagpipes everywhere.
A lot of it is quite simple, really. It comes down... Actually, before I get onto that, I should say that we are going to do a full ECOS debrief with Lionel and Simon for our next episode, because there have been a few emails for people, you know, wanting to know how they did it, the kit they took, that sort of stuff. So we're going to get under the skin of bike slacking, I think, is the title that they've come up with. But in terms of making the show, it all started back in 2021 before... Well, when, you know, Lionel and Simon had initially gone to do the ride, and we know what happened there, and we know that Lionel had had a bit of a crisis and couldn't do it, and I was so pleased that he was able to go back and do it. But back then, Lionel talked about, oh, it's about football grounds, and so I, you know, initially thought of the grandstand, you know, the final score being read out, and that was the starting point, really, with a bit of folk music, because that sort of feels Scottish, and we made that in 2021, and we just sort of sat on it, and then when Lionel was due to go back, we sort of resurrected that. And I mean, luckily, I mean this is very boring, it's a very, you know, very dry answer, but I've got access to a music library that I use, and if you search for Scotland, there's a lot of stuff. Obviously, there's the kind of on the nose bagpipey bits, but there is a lot of, you know, Celtic sort of folky guitar stuff. And that just sort of became the motif. And then as we were making it, I started to discover that a lot of the football clubs had sort of folky type songs associated with them. And I just sort of started researching those, really. And for me, it's funny, actually, some of those songs, I've got no affiliation with any of those clubs. Some of those songs brought a tear to my eye. It was they were genuinely beautiful. And then, you know, credit to Lionel and Simon, because I think one of the hard things when you're doing a ride like that, there are some days where you actually don't want to pick up the mic. And they did. They recorded everything. They were so, I mean, I have spent the last few weeks, I've listened to, I mean, what was it? There's about 15 hours worth of stuff that's gone out on the feed. There's loads that I've listened to that didn't make the feed. So, I mean, I have listened to about 20 hours of lying up just going for a bike ride. But you know what? I mean, Lionel said to me when he made it, I think Lionel lacked a little bit of confidence in it at times, but I've said, and I said this since 2021, that it was going to be one of the best things he's ever done. And it was. I mean, I remember the Lionel of Flanders series that we made back in the day, and when Lionel went, also when he went out to Liège, Bastogne, Liège, and, you know, they were great, and it was just, you know, Lionel mucking about with his bike, really.
Yeah, and Lionel's such an exceptional storyteller.
Yes.
That, you know, that's the heart of it, really. And then when you put excellent production on top, and I think the amazing thing is that, you know, particularly in episode 3, really, you know, you could go from sitting there weeping, being overcome with emotion, to the next minute laughing with a face still full of tears. And I think that was what was really so beautiful about it all. And the ability for it to transport you to Scotland through the music and the description of the place as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've lived in Edinburgh for about 3 or 4 months, and that's my experience of Scotland pretty much. And but I did, you know, I did sort of feel like I was discovering the place with them. It was so very so very, very vivid. But he's, you know, I mean, one of the things I think with podcasting, I mean, we are supposed to talk about cycling, but one of the things with podcasting is it's very intimate, and I think we sometimes lose sight of the fact that people listen to us, and you almost become a friend to them. You become part of their family and sort of stuff, and that's why you can happily spend so much time just in Lionel and Simon's company. You know, whatever they're doing, whether they're going to a football match, you know, drinking Iron Brew, whatever. It's just, it's nice to be in that company. And I mean, the other thing we've got to say is it's been a lovely way to be reminded of and to remember Richard. And I felt a degree of connection to Richard that I've wanted to feel. And I've also felt, it's just a sort of a healing, process, and I hope that kind of came across. It certainly came across to, you know, what Lionel and Simon were saying, but just across the series, yeah, it's definitely. And I know, and I've said this to Lionel, it's exactly the type of show where Rich would have texted you or messaged you and said, "I love that," and that would have really been genuine and would have meant something. So yeah,
I think that strength of connection, of feeling like somebody in a podcast is your friend, was really highlighted with the loss of Richard. And of course, we saw the outpouring of emotion, you know, across the media and the number of the Cycling Podcast listeners who felt like they'd lost a friend. And perhaps their family members didn't quite understand the grief that they were going through, because they felt so close to him, because they've been listening to his voice in their ears every week, every day, sometimes for years and years, and feel like they know him so, so intimately. And it's an incredible space to be able to tell a story and to remind everybody of, you know, the importance of somebody in our lives. And yeah, and it was just so beautifully produced, and that brought it all together. So thank you, Tom. It was very beautiful to listen to.
Well, thank you very much. And I say I'm only as good as the audio I get given. And luckily at the moment I'm getting given, you know, aside from the Cycling Podcast, I'm working on a few other things as well. I just the last month has been very, very, very draining creatively, very, very busy.
Hopefully very rewarding.
Yeah, if you just check my Twitter feed, you know, if you want to have a look at some of the other stuff I've just been so busy. But yeah, it's been a real privilege, and I'm looking forward to us doing it again as well. There is we'll talk about this with Lionel when we see him in the next episode, but there is talk of another series and another series beyond that. So there's a few other trips.
How much Lionel can you handle? Well, I think we might have to have the full uncut Tour de Corse in 2023. But in the meantime, I think it might be January before we get this episode out, because we've called their press officers and we are trying to nail them down, but they are very much in demand. Of course, we've got the winner and the second place rider at the Tour de Corse. Everybody wants a piece of them, but we're going to try and nail them down in person during the Christmas period, go for a ride with them. We'll try and get one of us to puncture. Simon can change it. And I'm sure we'll spend a lot of time in the cafe and we'll hopefully be able to bring you a bit of a breakdown of the Tour de Corse Tech course.
I'm really looking forward to going to Not Watford. It's actually one of my old stomping grounds around there. When I used to live in London, I used to ride around there a lot. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that. But Lizzie, before we get into the interview that you've done, I just wanted to just catch up with you. I said at the top of the episode that you were much more in pro cyclist mode than I've seen you for a long, long time. Training camp
thanks for emphasizing how long it's been, Tom.
Well, it's been almost as long as the Tour de Corse, I think. But where are you at then, Lizzie? Tell us.
Well, I'm actually, by the magic of podcasting, when you listen to this and when this goes out, I'm probably going to be on the way to the US, which is very exciting because in a couple of weeks, I've got our first camp for the 2023 season, media camp over in California in Silicon Valley, where two of our sponsors are based, TIBCO and Silicon Valley Bank, of course. And I'm heading out for a week and a half before that to go and see a friend over there, go and do some training over there. And I'm back on the bike and, I'm just, I'm a professional cyclist again for all intents and purposes, actually training again. And very happy to say that I can finally increase my training steadily, both in duration and in the heart rate that I can ride after... 8 months really with pericarditis. It's been a pretty bumpy road. It's been a really, really difficult road. I mean, I still don't really know how it's going to go from here. I'm trying to be careful so that I don't overdo it and risk recurrence of pericarditis, which is something that's quite common. And I had sort of multiple times during the last 8 month period, I would think I was fine and then it would come back again. I seem to be in the clear. I've been riding for about a month and a half now, steadily increasing things. But I mean, the main thing, you know, aside from any goals as a professional cyclist, is it is just so good to be back on my bike. We live just under the shadow of this big mountain in the edge of the Jura, 1700 meters. And you know, every day I look out my door and I see this giant mountain, and I've been wanting to get up it, and finally last weekend we went for a walk up it, and it's just such a relief. I can't describe how nice it is to be able to go and exercise again after not having been able to do so for such a long time. But I mean, the scale of the injury, it's almost as if I've broken my leg. I really haven't done any exercise for 6 months, so I'm incredibly unfit. And you know, my watts are measured in tens, not in hundreds. But they're steadily going up in tens each week as well, and that in itself is really nice, actually, because I'd say normally, you know, you're getting like 1 or 2 watts here and there, but now, you know, if you have a 10 watt increase every week or sometimes 20 watt, it's very encouraging.
Well, I mean, it's ideal prep for the Tour de Not Watford. I don't think that's going to strain you too much.
I expect to take a solid third place out of you, me and Lionel, because of course Simon's going to be driving the broom wagon because he's got a broken leg.
Broken his leg, yeah. I mean, I was going to say, I haven't done a bike ride that's been over an hour.
Well, we'll be quite equally matched then.
Probably, you know, I'm very good for an hour, you know, of intervals, but beyond that, it's unknown, really.
Well, I have absolutely no endurance, so I can guarantee that exactly 2 hours, my glycogen stores run out and I bonk quite spectacularly. And I usually end up lying on the floor and doing quite a lot of moaning. My friends can attest to this. So as long as we don't go for more than an hour or 2 hours between cafe stops, I think we'll be okay.
Oh, it's the interesting thing that on that front, I mean, what you've been through is a little bit unprecedented, really. There isn't the knowledge, is there, to know how to deal with these things. So you have kind of been fumbling around in the dark, really, trying to find a way to get through this. So, I mean, what have you learned?
Well, it's interesting, actually, and I think I could do probably a whole series of podcasts on it. And what I also have found, again, similarly to the concussion, is that there's not much information out there. And just
can you
by
just start getting regular problems, Lizzie, that we have medical knowledge of?
Like, I know, that would be nice, wouldn't it? Just break a collarbone. I mean, I'd prefer to not break anything or have any more problems for the moment. But no, I mean, just by kind of posting my story, you know, then you find out more people that have got it. And quite often when professional cyclists have an affliction, they disappear off the face of the earth because it can, you know, it can affect your career to tell people what's wrong with you. But I don't really believe in hiding things. I'm a very honest person. I believe in honesty and integrity. And I also believe that if you can share something and it can help others, then you should do that. I think the problem is that, you know, pericarditis is a relatively common condition. It's something that happens, you know, it's very well known about, very well documented. But I would say pericarditis due to COVID is different. It responds differently. It reacts differently. You have different sort of medical biomarkers, or in my case, I had none. You know, that was what was very confusing for people. Usually you go and you have a blood test and your CRP, which is your marker of inflammation, is very high. Mine wasn't at all. Yet I had fluid all the way around my heart, which obviously had indicated that I'd had, you know, quite severe inflammation. And I also had two healing pleural effusions, so, you know, fluid on both of my lungs, which was also due to the inflammation from the COVID infection or post-COVID infection. And so that's the confusing thing. All of my medical tests were relatively normal, yet I had quite a complicated illness. And I think that many, many people with sort of long COVID or COVID associated diseases are finding that their tests say they're fine, but they are very much not fine. And, you know, I was so fatigued to the point where you couldn't do something. And the fatigue that you feel with this is so different to the fatigue of being tired from being a bike rider. And then, and it was funny, you know, after the first sort of couple of weeks of riding again, I said to my husband, like, I'm so tired. And he said, I actually find this really reassuring, because sort of this is the normal bike rider Lizzie coming back. And it was such a completely different type of fatigue to the fatigue that I had when I was unwell. So, I mean, I've learned a huge amount about the illness. I've been in contact with a huge number of people to, you know, kind of discuss about, you know, my experience with the illness. I've read a lot about other people's experience with the illness. And yeah, I mean, I hope I've managed to help quite a few people as well. But there's also a huge component of autonomic nervous system dysfunction, which we kind of spoke about a bit when we talked about concussion, which can kind of, you know, it can change so many things. It can give you headaches, it can make you feel dizzy, it can change your blood pressure, it can change your glucose regulation, it can change your sleep, your anxiety levels. A lot of people struggle with that after COVID. And it can also affect your heart rate, which is thankfully the only thing that I'm still struggling with. But actually, before, earlier in the illness, I sort of got a whole host of these things, and it's one of the reasons why people get brain fog. So, but it is possible to manage it. It's difficult, but it's possible to manage it. And I've been sort of trying to manage it by dipping myself in very, very cold water. But yeah, now that it's winter and I keep getting colds, that's gone off the boil a bit. But no, it's been one hell of a journey, and I hope that I'm at the beginning of a different journey. And it's going to take a long time to get back to fitness. I think it'll probably take, you know, 4 or 5 months, I would imagine. But I really hope that this is the end and the beginning of something else. So, yeah.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, and this is Lionel here to tell you that this episode of Service Course is sponsored by GCN Plus. Now, the cyclocross season is up and running. Well, it's up and running and riding, of course, because that is the nature of cyclocross. And you can catch all of the biggest races live on GCN+. They have all of the action from the men's and women's UCI Cyclocross World Cup, the Super Prestige Series, and the X2O Bad Cammers Trophy, live and ad-free all season long, with expert insight from the commentary team, which includes Marty McCrossan, former US National Cyclocross Champion Jeremy Powers, and multiple former British National Cyclocross champion Helen Wyman. If you can't watch the races live as they happen, you can also catch up with full replays on demand. Now, Tom Pidcock is back in cyclocross action already, but Matthew van der Poel makes his season's debut on November the 27th at the Hulst World Cup in the Netherlands. That will be live on GCN+. Wout van Aert will have to wait a little bit longer for his season's debut, but that will be live on GCN+ too, no doubt. You can enjoy all of the best live racing all year round. There's no off-season when it comes to GCN+, because once the cyclocross and the track events wind down and the road season comes back, GCN+ is your ultimate cycling destination, showing all of the biggest events live and on demand. And of course, you can also explore the archive of incredible original cycling documentaries which are available on GCN+. There are over 140 films showing on demand, and new releases are added every week. When it comes to the live racing, there are sometimes territory restrictions that apply, but you can check out the GCN Plus website to see what you can watch and when. All of our UK listeners can get 25% off an annual GCN Plus subscription by heading to gcn.eu/cyclingpod. We'll put that website address in our show notes, but it's gcn.eu/cyclingpod to get 25% off an annual GCN Plus subscription if you're based in the UK.
Well, Lizzie, we've just been talking about sort of resoluteness, I guess, and you were at Ruler Classic talking about that, and that's where our interview comes from, right?
Yes, absolutely. Well, as I'm sure some of you will remember, a couple of years ago on the podcast, around this time of year, we had Henry Furness on. Now, you might know his name because Henry Furness was one of the co-founders of Windy Miller, and he's no longer part of Windy Miller because he's off doing other inventor extraordinaire things. And 2 years ago, he wanted to tell us all about his new project, but he couldn't really tell us about his new project. So he sort of told us around his new project. Now, about 2 weeks before Ruler, I got a message from Henry saying that his project was at the next stage, and that not only did he want to tell me about it, but how he wanted to tell me how the cycling podcast had actually played a role in the development of his project. Now, Henry is a brilliant talker, so I think I'm just going to let him tell you all about it. And we were sitting outside of Ruler on a very busy brick lane, so please bear with me with the background noise. But hopefully it'll give you a little bit of the atmosphere of London's busy East End. Well, I am sat on Brick Lane just before we go into Ruler Live with Henry Furness. Now, Henry, you were on the podcast a couple of years ago, and you were telling us all about your idea that you couldn't quite tell us about. 3D printing, lugs, and something about a new bike, but you just couldn't say anything yet. But that was actually the beginning of a cycling podcast love story, wasn't it? So do tell us what happened next.
Yeah, it was. It really was. It sort of, you know, for starters, we're still pre-launch, so there's only so much we can say, but we can say a lot more, and it's been a really exciting journey. But it really taught me the power of the podcast, because our very small collective we had back then, really just two or three of us, has swollen to 10, and two of those came directly from people who listened to your podcast.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. I mean, both very significant. One is an industrial designer. And the other is somebody who's come on board as a US partner now, and especially with the gravel scene, which is where we are going to launch first. It's huge in America, and to have a man on the ground there is amazing.
Well, I didn't know that we were a dating service, so anybody else wishing to be part of our tech dating service, please do reach out. So the next thing is, well, tell us what you've created, because you couldn't tell us last time, but now you have a product that you can tell us about. So what is it?
Yes, yeah, so I think when we spoke to you last, it was lockdown. It was right at the beginning of lockdown, and we were experimenting with 3D printing lugs in different materials. Some of which turned out to be like cheese, and some of which were a little bit better. And as that project unfolded, I got talking to more people within my network that I'd got from what I did before in cycling with my previous brand, and was introduced to new people, and new people specifically within 3D printing. And the project developed from there. And fast forward to where we are now, we've been prototyping. We're making our first production prototype at the moment. We're calling it the Christmas bike because its self-imposed deadline has to be ready before Christmas. And yeah, very exciting.
Well, what actually is it? We know you've got your 3D printed lugs, but other than that, what actually is your bike and what is it called?
What's it called and what is it? Oh, okay. So we have a brand name which we'll put out there in the spring next year, which is when we'll most likely launch. And
keeping it under wraps yet again. We'll have to speak to you in another 2 years to find out the brand name. But okay, tell us.
Yeah, well, hopefully sooner than that. Hopefully you'll see that in the spring, all being well. We're launching with a gravel bike. That part's no secret. We decided fairly early on to do that. Actually, not for the reasons people might think. We didn't do that because gravel's on the up and up, certainly in some countries. We actually did it because using a fairly new disruptive technology, certainly a technology that hasn't been democratized beyond federations, we decided to go for gravel first because it's still not settled on standards really in gravel. No one really knows what a gravel bike is if you ask them. And if we did something with our first bike that was already very well defined, like an aero road bike, for example, we'd kind of be quite constrained by the sort of design processes that go into aero road bikes at the moment and the marketing expectations, which, you know, to a large degree is why a lot of aero road bikes look very similar. I was just looking at a brand that's launching here at Ruler Live, actually, and I was thinking, what a lovely bike. But on the other hand, I was thinking it looks great, looks amazing. I'm sure it is amazing, but it's another bike that looks like a Specialized S-Works tarmac.
And how's it going to differentiate itself from the rest of that market?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that's a really big part of what we've been asking ourselves right from the beginning. You know, we don't want to just make something because we can. So right from the beginning, we've been asking ourselves at every point in the process, what problem are we solving, both for ourselves as manufacturers and also for the customer? Which in the end is really important, because if you're not solving any problems for the customer, why would they buy one over and above the gazillions of other bike brands that are out there?
So, well, you're going to put your money where your mouth is then and tell us, what is that problem you're solving? Are you 3D printing the whole bike? Is it specific to the customer's requirements? What is the product that you're actually going to offer?
Yeah, so we're not 3D printing the whole bike. You'll have seen a whole bike that was 3D printed on the track recently, which Ganna used to win the AIR record. Yes. By one of our collective, I should add. That bike, if you wanted to buy one, would be £75,000. So talking about solving customer problems, we'd have created a massive one if we went to market.
You know, actually, I think it was 75,000 euros. So you might actually get it for about £65,000.
Okay, so I've just exaggerated grossly there. So it's only 65,000.
It's only 65, so you can go out and buy one. And no. But tell us, what does your bike actually offer the consumer?
So for starters, we needed to get the price right. So any of those bikes that are made for federations, if you look at the bikes on the track, they can be around £30,000 if you want a track bike that's made in this way. There's other brands using similar technology, or really just one or two, which are right at the very, very tippy top end of premium and have very long wait times, which is another one of the things we needed to overcome. So we are first taking that technology and finding a way to make frames in a scalable way so that we can democratize the price point, first of all, to a premium price point that's in line with other bike brands. Mm-hmm. But it's absolutely our journey to really try and own the voice of this technology based on the collective that we've got, and then democratize it further to a mid-range price point, and then who knows, further down the line. 3D printing's just moving so fast, it's so exciting. And, you know, almost, I mean, don't quote me exactly on this, but it feels like it's practically getting twice as fast each year, and the cost of 3D printing is reducing by half. I mean, that's probably an exaggeration, but it's moving very, very fast. And even things like experimenting with thermoplastics rather than using traditional carbon fibre is an area that's moving really fast too. And there are bike brands that are using it already. I think personally they're jumping the gun. It doesn't react well to high temperatures and things like that right now, which, you know, is a problem if you're riding your bike somewhere over 35 degrees or if you leave it in the back of the car. But it's moving really fast, and things like thermoplastics are exciting because we can use the same molds we're using for our conventional carbon fiber. And
so with thermoplastic, you'd be talking about using that for the whole frame, would you, if that were a viable technology?
No, we'd still just use it for the intersection. So to answer one of your earlier questions, we're just 3D printing lugs.
And what material are you using for that at the moment?
So for the lugs, we are experimenting with both titanium and scandium alloy. We'll probably roll with the latter. It's fairly new for lugs using scandium alloy. It was, I think, first used by Airbus for 3D printing. Mm-hmm. It just has a few qualities that work better for us in post-production of the lugs. And no one's really done it before, which makes it quite exciting too. I say no one's done it before, when Ganna's entire frame was made of scandium alloy, or scalm alloy, whatever you want to call it.
Scalm alloy. So you got your scalm alloy lugs?
Yes.
And how does that transfer into having a sort of, you know, firstly a full bike, secondly a rapid process for the customer, which is something you say that you want to, you know, you want to avoid these long delays that you can get through bike shops. You want to avoid the fact that you know, with a traditional bike it's designed and then it doesn't actually come to fruition in the bike shop for, you know, another year maybe. So how is it that you can firstly get to that full bike from just the lugs? What other materials are you using, and then how do you actually reduce those supply chain delays, it's not really a delay, just supply chain sort of elongations that come with the traditional bike manufacturing process?
Yes, so these are all really, really good questions, and you're squaring off a lot of our sort of problem solving. So we really decided at the beginning that what we wanted to do was overcome what I call the antique supply chain, which a lot of the industry has, that's beyond their control. So we're trying to think of how do we create a better way to make and sell a bike. So COVID obviously caused massive problems. We spoke at the beginning of COVID, and I think right then people didn't know if things were going to dive or boom, and things did boom, and the supply chain's always been really difficult in cycling anyway. It was really bad before COVID, and COVID was just the final nail in the coffin, and it made it completely untenable. So we figured, first off, how can we get control of our production process? So we're making everything here in the UK, and it's not because we think the UK is necessarily a better place to make anything. People make fantastic bikes in Italy and China, or wherever it is, but you're still then beholden to shipping costs, someone else handling your production, and all of these things cause delays and can cause problems with quality control and all that sort of thing. So first off, we're making everything here.
But just as a caveat to that, I assume that doesn't mean you're only selling to the UK.
No. So here's one of the other things. So this isn't necessarily something that, well, it's sort of indirectly a customer benefit. So as we globalise, if we're lucky enough to globalise, as I mentioned before, we've got a US partner now, so we'll launch both sides from the beginning. As we grow in any particular country, because our fabrication process is very simple, that's taking your lugs and bonding them to the carbon fibre sections to fabricate the actual frame itself, we can do that anywhere. We can print lugs anywhere. We can mold our tubes anywhere because it's not.
And so you're
frames.
Making those tubes yourself as well?
Yeah. So that, as we globalise, that production would be local. It would be regional within different countries, if that makes sense. So there would be no international shipping. So if we're selling lots of bikes in America, we'll make lots of bikes in America because the process is so simple. And likewise, if we sold lots of bikes in Mexico, we'd make lots of bikes in Mexico. which makes the whole process much easier. There's a lot of shipping issues that are easier to overcome. It's more sustainable. You can overcome those supply chain issues. So our sort of utopian situation to be in would be every bike, every colour, every size available every day. And of course, it would take a long time to get to there. And all of us are, you know, it's probably the wrong thing to say held hostage by, but we all have to use really the big three component manufacturers. And they're still playing catch up. And
I was about to ask the same thing, because it is such a problem with the supply chain, and it's actually been almost one of the biggest problems with the supply chain over the last couple of years throughout COVID. You have been able to get a frame, maybe it's not the exact model or colour or whatever that you've wanted, but if you want to get your hands on a chain, you simply can't. And you know you need at the moment, I assume you're going to need a bike with a chain, unless you're planning on doing a direct drive.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I've almost felt, well, what's the right word? It's been a good thing for us that we've taken our time in production and doing all our R&D with this, which has been one of the nicest things about this project. We just haven't been in a rush. So we've really been able to take our time and think, you know, how do we get this right? And all the while I've been thinking, thank God we're not in the market at the moment. Mm. Now you have people saying, you know, there's been an overproduction of parts. Soon the market will be saturated and everyone will be selling components rock bottom because there'll be so much. Honestly, if that happens, I'll eat my underpants. I can't see it being easy to get components anytime soon. And, you know, if that was a thing, then great. You know, our business model is based on our frame and creating something that solves problems and enhances adventures through that. And obviously the components are secondary. We don't make them ourselves. But, you know, we are deep in the planning to make sure that we have availability of parts as and when.
Okay, so you've told me why the bike structurally is different, but how, you know, what will it offer to the consumer in terms of ride quality, geometry? You know, is it different to something you're just going to pick up off the shelf?
Yeah, so
and what level of customization is there? Like, can you customize it to your needs, or is it, you know, customizable within a sort of set boundary?
Yeah, so we're using 3D printing so that we have a really versatile size range. So what it means, traditionally you'd have your full custom frame where you measure someone up and every tube is cut to the size of the rider and you have a full custom bike, or you've got an off-the-peg bike. We are creating, I suppose, a unique middle ground.
Yeah, middle ground.
Whereby the versatility we're able to offer in sizes negates the need for full custom, yeah. But it also sidesteps any of the constraints that you might get from normal off-the-peg frames. And that comes down to the agility of 3D printing. Because we're printing the lugs, we have no tooling costs for the lugs. We're printing into air, basically. So we're able to very reactively make different sizes. We won't do full custom, but a good example, I suppose, is if you think of your sort of mammal who's absolutely set on getting the latest sort of Pinarello. No, it's the bike he wants. No one's going to talk him out of it. He's going to get it even though the geometry is really racy and it's totally inappropriate for him. We'll be able to have that bike that he wants, but because we're 3D printing, we'll be able to have three different variants of a size large, for example. So he'll still be able to get the bike he wants, but he'll be able to get the appropriate geometry. And that will still be viable for us. That's the key thing. And we'll still be able to make that quickly. And as we learn from the market, we'll be able to stockpile the right sizes.
I mean, it is a problem. I mean, just on a very simple scale, my husband was, you know, really between a 54 and a 56. And it was either one bike with a long stem or one bike with a short stem. And so, you know, we went for the long stem because it's going to be slightly better handling than a frame that's too big with a short stem. But it doesn't seem like the biggest problem in the world, but it is a bit of a problem. And I found that myself with a lot of frames. Sometimes I'm sort of halfway between a, you know, depending on the brand, 49 and a 51, and you're just kind of having to make compromises. And so if you're able to minimize those gaps between the sizes and kind of work out what actually works for everybody, like you say, without actually running at a loss, then hopefully it should make people happier on the bike. If you fit the bike, if you're comfortable, then you're going to be happier and you're going to want to ride it more, which at the end of the day, from my point of view, is the main thing. I want to get more people on bikes. I want to get more people riding bikes and being happy. I know whilst I've been stuck off the bike for the last goodness knows how many months, it's been difficult and I've been really unhappy. So for me, it's just about finding a bike that makes you happy. And if it fits you better, it's going to make you happier.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, there's lots of other fringe benefits as well, because even with a full custom bike, you know, the notion is that you're going to have a bike that fits you perfectly. And it's very easy to get a bike that fits you perfectly. But for somebody to design a bike that's going to have a great ride quality and handle really well is actually very, very difficult. So there'll be a lot of people out there on custom bikes that feel really comfortable but ride like an absolute pig. Those people probably don't realise because they've got no point of reference. But because all of our geometries are pre-designed by our geometry designer, we know that they're all going to ride really nicely. So there's that assurance as well. And another great thing about 3D printing, when you look at the agility and the versatility of it, is we 3D print our fork crowns. So another great irony with custom bikes is that they'll generally all use a standard fork. And it's kind of like the poor fork, you know. There's this custom frame and then you're just chucking a standard fork on it.
Always wondered why that's the case. Is it just because it would be so difficult to create your own fork otherwise?
This comes down to the same thing. It's moulding and expense. So there are brands that have different fork rakes across their range, but they're fairly few and far between. But what it means for us is it's just not a price issue. It's no extra cost. We just have three or four different fork crowns ready to print and print them as and when we need them, depending on demand for different fork rakes. And my wife is not crazy small. She's 5'5", but actually to get a bike that rides okay for her, you know, I remember at one point 3T were making a fork with a good fork rake, but they decided to stop doing it for whatever reason, and they only had 5 left globally, so I just bought all 5.
And is she still riding them now?
She actually is. She won't on her next bike because they were rim, and so that's no longer a thing, but we did, you know, I think we used them all up. We certainly maybe Windy Miller still has a set, but anyway, you know, these are all the things that 3D printing is great for working around. And then the other thing, of course, is how fickle the industry is, especially with gravel. You know, nobody really knows where it's going to land. I don't think it's going to land on any standards anytime soon. And if you've got your monocoque frame, it's a major consideration, obviously, to change something. But with 3D printing, we can be really reactive to, I mean, I say market trends, credible market trends that people want. You know, we can be very reactive. We can be right at the cutting edge of that.
Yeah, and you can be there, you know, a lot faster. So tell me a little bit more about the brains behind the operation. Obviously, we know about your history with Windy Miller, and go back to listen to the episode where we spoke to Henry. I think it was November 2020. I think it was November 2020, actually, that we were speaking to you last time, if you want to hear a little bit more about Henry's history. But who else is there in this collective? Because I think there's some pretty big names in the world of cycling design and tech, isn't there?
Yeah, there are. And I think, you know, actually there's a new one that's so new that we're still sort of crossing T's and dotting I's, so I better not talk about that one.
If it's done by the time we release the podcast, I'll slip
add
it
a
in.
Bit on the end. Yeah, exactly. So started out with a friend of mine who's a creative engineer. That's my word for somebody who loves experimenting with
inventor.
New stuff.
Inventor.
Cycling
almost. Inventor.
Kind of, yeah. Sort of the equivalent of, I think it's called a serial monogamist, somebody who's addicted to the first 3 months of a relationship. So he's got a workshop that's just littered with projects that are sort of 30% done, 40% done. And it was really good fun working with him, and I went in with an open mind. I had the measure of him. He's a good friend of mine, and you know, it was really exciting. We played around with different types of lugs and 3D printing on desktop printers, and making things that were made of cheese, making things that were a bit rubbery, which are definitely not things that you would associate with a nice, robust bike frame. But that was the seed of the idea. And then really through the next thing was connections in F1. So we made bikes for some of the F1 teams or for the drivers with Windy Miller. And I should stress that there was never any technical collaboration. This was just making our bikes for those teams. But it did put us on the radar of some of the composites companies in the UK that make frames for F1 teams. And I spoke to them a lot through the Windy Miller years, and we always wanted to do something together, but we were always so busy with the day-to-day, we never actually got round to it. So when we had one of our early 3D printed prototypes with lugs made of cheese, I decided to take it to see one of those guys.
I'm living in France now. Is that something I can get in the supermarket over there? Sounds like a delicious specialty.
So anyway, off I went to this sort of F1 Silicon Valley, and at this stage a friend of mine called Tim Allen was already in the mix, aka Swanier London. He's sort of one of London's top bike fitters. I'm biased, I would say the best bike fitter, but also deep into the cycle industry and trends and where things are going, and he's our geometry designer. So Tim and I and some of the guys on the marketing side headed up there, and they were really interested to get involved. Knew an expert in lug design and introduced us to him, and that was Dimitris Katsanis, who of most recent Ghana Hour record fame.
Yeah, but I mean, we've spoken about Dimitris Katsanis a lot on the podcast, because of course he was he played a big part in designing the GB Cycling Hope Lotus track bike with Tony Purnell. He's been part of the Secret Squirrel Club at GB for many years. I'm not sure if he still is. He also designed the Pinarello. I say the new Pinarello. It's not a new Pinarello anymore, but the old new Pinarello for the 2020-2021 Tokyo Olympic Games. He's someone we know well on the podcast for designing a lot of the kind of the big new exciting very expensive track bikes out there.
Yeah, that's right. So I mean, Dimitris actually at the last count, I think he totted it up. He's got over 100 Tour de France wins, gold medals, and now you can just add two hour records actually, because there was Dan Biggin's one first to his name, which is, you know, I think you could say that other organisations are maybe as well decorated, but I don't think one single individual has had such a profound impact on cycling as Dimitris has. So a lot of the bikes that he's been involved with using 3D printing have been for federations. So no one had ever really looked at democratising that technology and getting it to a point where you could make a bike that's available for anybody. So that's really what we decided to do. Mm-hmm. And whilst Dimitris isn't our frame designer, he is our 3D printing lead, and he's very much part of the project. He's on board with it, part of the collective. So we're very lucky, feel very honoured to have him as part of it, and it very definitely means we're not reinventing the wheel. So that was a big turning point for us. So he had always wanted to democratise something like this, but rather like I was saying with Windy Miller, when the guys from the composites companies were talking to me, you're so busy with the day-to-day you don't get around to it. And we had already formed the seed of this collective, so Dimitris was, you know, I'd love to help you guys, you know, at least on the 3D printing side. He was very resolute about the fact that he couldn't, you know, he designs frames for other people, so we luckily already had our chief frame designer by then, a guy called John Hale.
Just a quick reminder that we're in a busy brick lane, if you hadn't noticed. So you had your chief designer, John Hale.
Yeah, John Hale. It really went onwards and upwards from there. And we were also very lucky in so much as one of the bigger composites manufacturers here in the UK who makes components for 5 or 6 of the F1 teams, and also aerospace, defence, various bits and bobs like that, were really keen to get their teeth into an exciting project that wasn't under NDA, because practically everything they do is under NDA, so they can't shout about it. And we were the opposite. We wanted to, you know, form this collective of people that you know, all had a really strong skill set to bring to the party, but we didn't want them to be suppliers. We wanted everyone to be part of this collective. So we're very lucky that they decided to come on board too. So they're invested in the project. They're, you know, it's all collective owned. And I should stress that with this type of technology, there's just no way we could have done it if we hadn't used the relationships we had. As a new person joined the collective, the network and relationships we had got stronger and stronger. So because we're all part of it, we're all giving to the collective at this stage to get to a point where we have our minimum viable product. And I, you know, I couldn't put a number on it, but we would be in so deep financially now if we are outsourcing and actually paying market rate for that stuff. It just wouldn't be possible. And so I'm so grateful for the relationship and network that I was lucky enough to get through Windy Miller, and it really was the launch pad to this. So there was so much value in that.
Well, it's not long now until we head off Busy Brick Lane into the tranquility of Rue L'Air Live. Time for one more question. What is there to stop somebody else copying your technology? Because it seems so easy and so, well, easy once you've got the knowledge, of course, and done all the research, and so scalable that why couldn't Specialized or Trek or Cannondale or whoever just pick this up and say, right, we're going to do it, and then take over that share of the market?
So I think they can, and I think they will. And I think, you know, give it 10 years' time and, you know, all bikes will be 3D printed and you'll practically be able to 3D print them on your home printer. But what I also know by being quite old now and quite long in the tooth is that you can have the best ideas and the best technology, but so much of it is about working out what that really means for the customer. How do we make this right for the customer? How do we create experiences that they can engage with that can enhance their adventure? And that part is so difficult, and you need a great collective of people. And I couldn't have done this without being off the back of 10 years in the industry already and managing to hook people that are so passionate about it. And you can't fake that, and it's really hard. As soon as companies get big, they always lose some of their soul. It's impossible not to. So we're lucky that we're at the beginning of this journey. So, you know, we're going to have that in its droves. And it is early days, and I would say on top of all that, we do have an unfair advantage though. We have Demetris, and you know, he's
the
better
secret gold medal winning weapon.
He's better than a patent.
Yeah.
For sure.
Well, I think you've told us all that you can tell us. And so hopefully once we have the name and you've launched the product, we'll get you back on the podcast and you can remind us all about it.
Exactly. That would be amazing. And then, you know, we'll be able to tell you much more about the journey and how we got here. And yeah, very exciting.
You'll have an even larger collective of cycling podcast listeners by that point, I'm sure.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, yeah. Who knows? Who are we going to find from this podcast that's going to join up? So
just contact Henry Furness.
Yeah, that's right.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, and this is Lionel here again to tell you that this episode of Service Course is also sponsored by NordVPN. Now, you'll be listening to the cycling podcast on your phone or tablet or a computer or laptop, no doubt, and I wonder how much thought you've given to your online security. I must admit, it's not something that I thought too much about a few years ago, but hearing about how easy it is for hackers to steal data online, I began to worry about some of the connections that I was using in the course of my work, whether that's hotel Wi-Fi or the Wi-Fi in a race press room or just tethering my phone to my laptop. I was wondering how secure those connections were. And so I actually signed up for NordVPN before they began sponsoring the cycling podcast. And it gives me the peace of mind to carry on wherever I am, at home or on the move. I suppose most of the stuff I'm doing online, not really a big concern, but something like logging on to the online bank and making payments, that kind of thing is something you want to be really sure is safe and secure. And so NordVPN, virtual private network gives you the security to know that your data is not at risk from hackers. You can use NordVPN on up to 6 devices. It doesn't slow down your internet connection, and there are all sorts of other advantages to it as well. And all Cycling Podcast listeners can get an exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/TCP. You'll get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan, plus an additional month for free. And it's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. So go to nordvpn.com/TCP to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan and surf the internet risk-free.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thanks as ever to Science in Sport for their continued support of all that we do here at the Cycling Podcast. And I personally would like to express my gratitude to Science in Sport for powering Simon and Lionel around Scotland on their Tour d'Écosse. And thankfully, Simon and Lionel never suffered the dread of bonk along the way, and they completed their mission. So, yeah, thanks to Science in Sport. If you want to get 25% off your next order with Science in Sport, just go to scienceinsport.com and enter the offer code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. Well, there's a few things there. Firstly, Lizzie, I love Brick Lane. Was always back in the day, I was always at Brick Lane Bikes because, obviously, you know, I ride a fixie. But also Brick Lane, one of the best places on earth to get a bagel.
To get a bagel. Well, I did go. I mean, I didn't realise that Ruler had an after party. So I did go and visit the Brick Lane bagel shop at 3 a.m. after Ruler. And I also didn't realise that the bagel shop was open 24/7.
24/7, that place. The other thing I was going to say is whenever you talk about people like Dimitri Katsaris and stuff, these guys that are in the shadows, yeah. I've actually got coming up sometime soon, I've actually been talking with one of the other figures who lurks in the shadows.
Deep in the shadows.
And he's a friend of Dimitri's. And it is a fascinating interview. And again, it's on that sort of new materials, revolution, not evolution sort of tip. So I'm excited to bring that. That's the kind of thing that really gets me excited, that stuff.
It's fascinating, isn't it, how the athletes get all of the glory? Because there is, I mean, obviously the athletes have to do the work, but essentially all the athletes have to do is have the right physiology and the right mentality.
Yeah,
then there's everybody else, but yeah, it's easy. You know, the only reason I was successful is because I'm absolutely pig-headed and so stubborn that I just will not give up. And that's just, you know, that's just hardwired. You know, it's not, you know, it's nothing special. It's just always been there. And, you know, you've got all these people behind, coaches, all these people in the shadows, you know, the Katsanises, the 3D printers, everybody, you know, making it work, the secret squirrelers. And they don't really get the glory, but they deserve it, don't they? But we're going to give them a little slice of the glory on this podcast.
Well, after we've dealt with giving Lionel a bit more glory, we'll get to this. Lizzie, listen, I'm going to let you go because you've got to pack your bag. You've probably got to do it. How do you get into America these days? You have to do a test before you go?
No, it's pretty easy. Let anyone in, even
oh,
me.
Oh, brilliant. Even you. Fantastic. Amazing. Well, listen, have a great camp. I hope it all goes well. I'm thrilled that I can say Lizzie Banks and training camp in the same sentence.
And riding awesome. A bike.
And yeah. Riding a bike, yeah. But that's awesome. And, well, Lizzie, well, hopefully, not even hopefully, it's going to happen. I will see you in person in about exactly a month's time.
I hope so. I hope so indeed.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hi there, we are James and Dan Twofort of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Each week we get around the microphones with our four favourite facts that we've learned over the last 7 days and sit down to blow each other's minds.
Yeah, here's a fact for you, Dan.
Yep.
In knot theory, a circle of rope without a knot is technically a knot, but it's called a knot knot.
Very good. I go on here as well. In 2019, a marathon runner with the words Jesus Saves written on his bib had a heart attack, but was revived by a man called Jesus.
That is amazing. If you want to hear more facts like that, search for No Such Thing as a Fish wherever you get your podcasts.